My name's Bob Darrell, and I am alcoholic. I'm grateful they didn't raffle off the podium. The most frightening thing in Alcoholics Anonymous to me was step 8 and 9. It was fear to the point of depression. When I would look at step 9, it was just too big. And I understood the implications, and you didn't have to hammer it. Every time you'd mention it in meetings I would be in, I'd just feel overwhelmed. I remember a guy just going on and on about it. I paid back every single dime I ever owed anybody. And I thought, oh my God. My parents alone, when I finally figured out what I owed them and came up with the game plan, it was 12 and a half years of payments. I lived a way of life where I stole every day. I mean, it was my life. And I'm not a gangster. It's all petty stuff. I'm the guy at the bar that I run out of money, so when you go to the bathroom, I drink your drink and steal your change off the bar. And move, or if a woman, you lay your purse down and it's nobody's looking, I'm out of there with it. I would break into cars and steal whatever I could, you know, that I might be able to sell. I did this one thing. It was a trick I did. I did it at least once a day, sometimes two or three times a day, where I'd go into a nice restaurant, a gas station, a bar, and they had cigarette machines. And I would go up to the cigarette machine, and I look like a bum. I got long hair and a beard, and I'm kind of unkept and a little bit dirty. And I'd go up to the cigarette machine. I'd pretend I was putting money in it. And then I'd make a big scene, slamming my fist on it, yelling it out at the top of my lungs, this machine ripped me off, until the manager would come out and open the machine and give me a pack of cigarettes to get rid of me. Now, I did that every day of my life, at least once a day, sometimes two, three times a day. I ripped off. I was telling somebody earlier, the other day, I lived in New York City for a while in the Village. And we used to go to this head shop and buy opium incense, and then we'd go get catnip, and we'd make bags full of catnip, and we'd rewrap the opium incense and sell it for ounces of opium down to the tourists from New Jersey and Connecticut. And, that was a way of life. I mean, so when you guys talk about, and I don't think I ever worked anywhere then. If there was something I could steal, I didn't steal it, you know? And you're talking about paying everybody back. I tried to do the math in my head. And I thought, if I had a really, really good job and I worked for 50 years, I won't make enough money gross to pay all that back. It was hopeless to me. And it was a point. Remember, it was feeling of that separation again. You know, that sickness that's inside of me that tells me that my case is different. It's either I'm better than you or I'm less than you. But I'm the thing that separates me and stops me from being just like you. And this was telling me, see, I'm worse than you. All these steps are fine for you, but they're not okay for me. I can't do them. This is another place where I will fail. And my experience new with looking at step 8 and 9 was very much like the experience a kid in, say, the fifth grade would have if he had to sit down and look at the tests he must pass in order to graduate from high school. A kid in the fifth grade is going to look at those tests, and he's going to feel hopeless. He doesn't even understand the questions. He can't even read all the words in there yet. I mean, he's going to give up. He's going to feel like, I'll never do that. But it doesn't matter what his perception is. It doesn't matter how he feels. If he shows up every day for school and does his homework, by the time he gets to the end of the 12th grade, he has everything in place to pass those tests. And Alcoholics Anonymous is very much like that in God's time. If you do the next indicated thing, by the time it's time to make an amends, you've got everything in place to do that. You've got the emotional conviction, you've got the willingness, and you've got the means. And God facilitates change. This thing, this principle that Carl Jung came up with of synchronicity. And synchronicity is a beautiful view of the universe. And it matches my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous exactly. And a synchronistic universe is a universe that waits to accommodate positive change. It's a universe that you may be in a position where you need to get, you're on the edge of an abyss and you need to get from point A to point B, but the abyss between those points is insurmountable. A synchronistic universe from the moment of desire starts making little tiny incremental shifts to make the impossible eventually inevitable. And that's the story of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, you go, you don't have to be sober very long. Go to meetings and hear the miracle stories. Hear the stories of the people who had their kids taken away by the courts and they would never get them back. And then you see them, they're with their kids in the meeting. You know, and this is not a rare occurrence in AA. This is a frequent occurrence in Alcoholics Anonymous. The homeless guy who was living behind the Al-Anon Club in the bushes just bought his first house, right? The guy who had done so much damage to his family, his mother and father will never speak to him again. And all of a sudden there he is with his parents again, and they're connected. And so you knew this. I didn't. And so I got lucky enough to listen to you when I would get all angst up over this stuff. And you just say, just calm down. Just do the next thing. You got a commitment. You got to go down. You're going to go over to the care unit. You're going to take a meeting. Just do the next thing. Let's see what happens. And I started to move through some of this stuff. And some of the amends that I was pushed into making when I was brand new, I was pushed into them, and I didn't come from a group that was, they weren't masters of the big book, and they had me do some things that by today's standards you'd probably consider, well, that was out of order. You made some amends before, you hadn't even done your fourth step yet. You shouldn't put that, take the money back, don't give it to them. I mean, you know, right? But these people, they didn't understand the mechanics and the nuts and bolts of Alcoholics Anonymous academically, but they understood the spirit, and their intuition was right. And they had me start making amends when I was new. And one of the first amends I was pushed into doing was I was facing 2 years in prison in Pennsylvania. I'd been sentenced in Beaver County to 2 years for a hit-and-run DUI of a stolen car. And in my own defense, legitimately, it was not a stolen car. It was a borrowed car. But that's, that's beside the point. And I got a judge, sentenced me to 2 years in prison, and then stayed the commitment and put me in a place on the north side of Pittsburgh called the Ark House, and I was supposed to go in there and stay for a year, get good UAs and good PO reports and make the restitution, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that's all sounds great if you have what it takes to stay sober for a year, but I don't. And a lot of people in AA can stay physically sober just by going to meetings for long periods of time. I'm not the guy. I have a bad case of alcoholism. I have a short fuse. Every alcoholic I've ever met has a fuse. And the frightening thing is you don't know how long the fuse is. But when the fuse gets down to the end, it's drinking time. And it doesn't, and sometimes you'll see people that they'll get drunk. If they don't get connected, they're drunk 1 or 2 days after they get out of detox. And then there are other people that can physically seem to go years. I've known people, I worked with a guy 23 years with the benefit of step none. And he was going to commit suicide. He was so totally alone because he's right about everything. And no, he just went like nobody. He had no one in his life anymore. 23 years, he's dying. Now, he is a tough guy. To go 23 years, untreated alcoholism. I mean, that's amazing to me, really. If we had like a grading of toughness when it comes to alcoholism, he'd be a John Wayne of alcoholism. I am, on the other hand, more of a Barney Fife kind of alcoholic. I mean, I put up a good facade in those cell blocks, but the truth is they don't let me have a bullet yet. I mean, I'm just that guy. And so I came quickly. And so they told me when I was new, they said, I'm facing this. I couldn't stay sober in the Ark House. I ended up drinking again. When I ended up drinking, I know what's happening. That there's gonna, it's just a matter of time. My PO is going to go to the courts. The warrants will be issued. I just know it. I'm convinced of it. And I ended up in Las Vegas, and I went to detox. I met my sponsor there. I get out of the detox. I'm living in a halfway house. And this, all of a sudden, my mind's clearing up, and I'm starting to think about what's happening in Pennsylvania with those warrants. You know, a friend of mine has a great saying. He says, the fog is lifted, but now the planes are landing, you know? Right? It's like, wow. And it was driving me insane. I mean, I had this anxiety over it, and this guy walked me through it. He told me that I had to turn myself in. And I didn't want to turn. I thought, no, that's a bad idea. He said, no, you're not going to stay sober. And he convinced me that I would die of alcoholism. I was going to drink again. I had to get free of looking over my shoulder and the anxiety that comes with that, or it will compel me and drive me back to drinking or taking something every single time. And he pretty much laid it out. You have a choice here. You either face this and get sober, or you don't face it, and it'll eventually emotionally eat your lunch, and you'll go back out again. And so he walked me through the process, and it was frightening. He told me that I needed to write my PO a letter, and he told me I needed to give him the address of the halfway house, which I thought was a very bad idea. I thought, well, I said, they could send marshals to pick me up. And he said, yeah, we want them to be able to find you. Yeah, yeah. I thought, this guy all of a sudden doesn't look so much like he's on my side. I know he said he was, but I'm not so sure anymore. And he said, tell him in the letter that you're sober again in Alcoholics Anonymous, give him the address, tell him where you're living, and that you want to clear this up no matter what it takes, and you're willing to come back and do the 2 years, and that anything else they wanted you to do. And I thought that they were probably going to tack on time, because I split and I crossed a whole bunch of state lines in fleeing, right? So in my mind, I'm thinking, oh man, they might. What if they had a year for every state I cross? I'm trying to get a picture of the map in my mind. God. And they said, tell your PO that you'll call him. Give him 10 days. He said 10 days is good. He'll have the letter by then, and they can have decided what they want to do with you. Give him a time and a day. 10 days out. He showed me I showed him the letter after I wrote, and he said, that's good. And he said, send that out right away, and then make sure you call him on that time of day. And I took the letter to the mailbox, and this, I'll never forget this. I dropped it in the mailbox, and then instantly I'm trying to get my arm in there to get it back. I remember that. And you can't get your arm in those mailboxes. And I waited that 10 days, and it was a hard, emotionally a very hard 10 days. I couldn't sleep a lot because I'm in my head, you know, thinking about going to prison. And, you know, I still have scars from times I was in county jails from fights I got on and stuff. I'm thinking, oh, man, I don't know if I can do this 2 years. Jesus. wonder if I'll get used to being married to Bubba. I mean, geez. You know, I mean, I'm haunted by all that, because my mind goes to worst case scenarios every time, you know. And the 10th day came, and I went to that phone. And I tell you, I was shaking inside. I was so scared. And I called, and this woman answered the phone, and she said, "He's expecting your call." And she puts me through to a man who I didn't really even know him. I sat in his office a couple times, I suppose. He had my case among probably a whole bunch of other people, I suppose. He had no reason to stand up for me or to do anything good for me. I'm just another bum who didn't do what he's supposed to do, you know. But he had gotten the letter that you guys had told me to write, the way you told me to write it. And he got on the phone and he said, "Look, we talked to my supervisor, we talked to the courts, and you don't have to come back here and do the 2 years." He said, "But we're going to transfer your case to Nevada. There's a place called CRS. It was down. It was an office that did all the DUI stuff for the court system in Nevada. You're going to have to report there. You're going to report to this man. You're going to have to send money to us until you make that right. You're going to probably, they're going to want you to give your analysis, I imagine, down there. You're going to have to go to some DUI classes. And if you can do all that at the end of a year, you're cleared, misdemeanor, time served, and we're not going to lay the felony on you." And I walked away from that phone call. I didn't know, I had never felt like that. I didn't know if I wanted to laugh or cry. I mean, I just felt amazing. I felt like something had been lifted off of me. And I don't even believe in God. But it was like getting a postcard from a God I don't even believe in. And it said, "Dear Bob, we got your back. Love, God." And it was the first time in my life I ever put what you suggested ahead of what I wanted to do and my own fears. It was the first time I ever trusted in something other than me. And I trusted in what you told me. And it worked out wonderfully. Matter of fact, years later, I was standing before the Nevada Gaming Control Board as they gave me one of the most prestigious licenses in the world, a license to be an owner operator of gaming. And I knew that I only was there getting that license because I did what you told me to do. Otherwise, it would have been the felony, I wouldn't have been eligible for that license. And you know, I think trust in most of us when we get sober is like an atrophied, unused muscle. And the thing about the only way you can strengthen it is you have to use it and you have to exercise it. And every time one of us pushes themselves aside and takes the actions of someone who may not even believe in God, but is willing to act like you not only believe in God, but you trust, the muscle gets a little stronger. And years of being forced into situations where you have to, there's nowhere to go. And doing this, and it gets stronger and stronger. The second amends that I had to make, that I made, and you encouraged me to make, and I wasn't at step 9 yet, technically, was towards my parents. I joined a home group. And I tell you, if you join a home group, especially if it's a bunch of activists, it's like inviting them to butt into your business. You don't know you're doing that, but they just start doing that. I mean, they start asking you questions. And one of the things they asked me, I was new. We're sitting around coffee one time, and somebody said, "So, how's your mom and dad? What's going on with them?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know." "What do you mean you don't know?" "Well, I haven't talked to them in several years." "Oh, so you haven't made amends to them yet, have you?" "No." And I said, "It's not that. It's not that at all. They won't take my calls. They won't have anything to do with me." I said, "Oh, you need to call them." I said, "They won't take my calls." And they said, "Don't call collect." I would have never thought of that. That's pathetic, isn't it? I mean, no, that really is pathetic. But the truth is, I wouldn't have thought of that. I always called, if I had to call my parents, you'd call collect. It was some kind of sick sense of selfish entitlement. They said, don't call collect. So they told me to write. They said, you can't miss Christmas, their anniversary, birthdays, Father's Day, Mother's Day, etc. You got to send them some little... Not something. I know you don't have a lot. You got to send them something. Got to send them something. And I started doing everything they told me to do. And I remember I called, the first time I ever called, my mother answered the phone. And when she heard my voice, you could hear a shrill, almost aggravation, like, what do you want? And then it shifted into like a little bit of a panicky voice. And then she said, oh my God, you're not back in Reading again, are you? I said, no, Mom, I'm in Nevada. She said, you're in Nevada? Well, the operator didn't ask me to pay for the call. I said, no, Mom, I paid for the call. She went, you paid for the call? She couldn't. It was like, it shocked her. It was so out of character for me. And that wasn't me, that was you. And I started doing those little things. I remember first Christmas. Oh, God, you know, I owe my dad so much. I wish it would have been easier if I had been abused as a kid or something, but my parents loved me. You know, I tried to blame them for stuff. Oh, they didn't understand me, or they wouldn't help. They stopped helping me. I tried to, but the truth is that I just wore them out. You know, I destroyed them emotionally, and I knew it too. I stole so much stuff from my parents. That there was only one pawn shop in Reading in those days on Penn Avenue. My dad became friends with the guy who owned the pawn shop from buying his own crap bag. Then the guy cut me off. My parents, when they cut me out of their life, I remember I was in a detox. I was in St. Joseph's Hospital. I had IV. I was a mess. And they came up there and they got the house key and they told me, you're not welcome in our house ever again and don't call us anymore for help. And I hated them for that. Probably saved my life. And well, they cut me physically out of their life, but I found out later that they couldn't cut me out of their heart. And so my mother ended up seeing her own therapist and taking medication to live with it. And my dad became the guy who slept, like he'd get up like 15, 14, 16 hours a day he'd sleep. And at one time, they were very active in the community. They belonged to the country club, the YR club. My dad was in the Lions club. My mom was in the women's club. She was in some other charitable organization. They were really good. They were involved in fundraisers and all kinds of altruistic things in the community. They were very connected and very social and active in the community. And the last several years of my drinking, they never left the house. They were a hostage because they couldn't take it anymore. They didn't want to go out because everybody would ask them about me. And they were just worn out. And I used to tell people I ain't hurting anybody except me. What a bunch of crap. And so I started doing this. And I remember the first Christmas, I was so far behind on my dad. And I don't have any money. I got a minimum wage job, basically. And you guys told me I had to get him something for Christmas. Well, I got my mom some little thing. I got my dad, who I really owed the most to. I got him a necktie. It was like a $9 necktie. It was pathetic. I mean, if I got my dad a new Bentley and a beach house, it's not even going to scratch the surface of how far behind I am with my dad. And I'm going to give him a necktie. I didn't want to do it. If you hadn't have made me do it, I wouldn't have done it. And then right after I sent it to them, they received it a little bit after Christmas. I called the weekly call I've been making. And the only person I ever talked to was my mom. My dad wouldn't talk to me. And my dad got on the phone. got on the phone and he tried to talk to me. And he said, thank you. And then the wall came back up again. As it should have, after all I've done to him. But it was a little movement. Just a little movement. As a result of me sending him that stupid necktie. Who'd have thought? When I was a year sober, they decided to come out to Las Vegas and eyeball me. They don't think, this is not a family reunion. They're skeptical. They think I'm a bum trying to get back in the will or something. You know what I mean? They're just, because I've conned them so many times that they don't trust me. But they have this attitude, you know, he's probably a bum, but hey, we've never been to Las Vegas, so it's not a complete mess. They flew out to Las Vegas, and I met them at the airport. I took them out to dinner with my sponsor, Dick, and his wife, Gladdy. And Dick said at the dinner, he invited them to my home group. And I didn't know. I'm not so sure that's a good idea. He thought it was a great idea. You know, it's funny looking back. Alcoholics Anonymous was, I was fairly new. I was a year sober. It was changing my life. And yet, when I was around my dad, I was embarrassed that I had to go to AA. Isn't that odd? It's a fun, like, as if I wanted him to respect me, and I thought that I should be able to beat this thing on my own for my dad's respect. My dad didn't care. He eventually knew that, well, I was doing better. I brought him to my home group, and that was a wonderful, wonderful idea, because my parents got to see me with you. I'm never better than when I'm with you. Never. You bring the best out of me. It's like that movie, As Good As You Gets, where Jack Nicholson says to Helen Hunt, you make me want to be a better man. And they saw me with you. It was perfect. It was perfect. My mother, I remember sitting there, and there was somebody talking about getting their kids back. And my mom was very affected by that. And she leaned over. I could hear her say to my dad, they used to call him Pidge. And he said, Pidge, this is good. This is good. And they laughed at some of the jokes. And it was a nice thing. And right before they left to go back to Pennsylvania, I was instructed by my sponsor to put together a list of what I believed I owed my father. And it was a lot. I mean, it was considerable. All the times that I jacked off the rent money and I needed it, or I was going to be thrown out, or needed to fix my car, the fines I didn't have the money to pay. And this was a lot of years of him loaning me stuff and bailing me out of bad situations. And I would all, you know, I'd always say, I'll pay you back. And I never paid him a nickel. And I put it all down on paper to the best of my ability, and I was instructed to go to my dad with a payment plan, and at the same time asking if I missed anything and added one. And I went to him with my deal, and I said, if there's anything else, let me know. And I want to start making these payments. And it was going to be 12 and a half years of payments. If you're a year sober, that's a lifetime. 12 and a half years of payments. There's a hopeless feeling behind. And I'm not against paying them back. I mean, I'll hit the lottery or something, and I'll pay them back. You know, and you guys wouldn't let me do that. You wouldn't wait. You couldn't let me wait till I'd get rich. People who do that never have anything to do. They never get to make the amends. He said to me that you sold your integrity a nickel and a dime at a time, and you're going to buy it back a nickel and a dime at a time. And so I had the payment plan. I said to my dad what I proposed it to him. And my dad surprised me. He said, Rob, we don't want you to pay that money back. He said, let's forget about it. We just want you to stay sober and keep doing what you're doing. This is the first time we've ever had any hope that you're going to be okay. Just forget about the money. And I, oh my God, I just got out of 12 and a half years of payments. I mean, I remember leaving the Stardust Cafe coffee shop on my way to my sponsor's office. Man, I am rock. I like amends. This is good, man. And I was, you know, there was other people I owed money to. I was wondering, if I could get them to see the light like my parents did, you know. And I walked into my sponsor's office, and he's sitting there at his desk, and I'm so excited. I said, I did exactly what you wanted me to do. And my dad said, I didn't have to pay him. Isn't this amazing? And my sponsor looked at me and said, doesn't matter what your dad said. This is your debt. This is your recovery. You got to pay him. And there are just times when you know you have the wrong sponsor. And I said to him, I said, what are you talking about? My dad doesn't want me to pay him. And he says, it doesn't matter. I said, well, there's no way to pay him if I send him this little check every month. My dad, he's not wealthy, but he's well enough off. He won't even cash it. He won't take it. And he said this, he had this crazy saying. He used to say, I don't know, but a way will be sure. What the hell does that mean? He understood something I didn't understand. He understood how God facilitates everything here in time, in his time. And I was working as a cashier. And I was working as a cashier in the store, and it was back in the 70s. And in the 70s, there was still a lot of silver coins and silver certificates and gold certificates in circulation, wheat pennies, war nickels, and my dad collected all that stuff. And I thought, I'll talk to my boss. I'll see if I can buy that stuff out of the register as it comes through. And maybe over a period of a year or two, I could accumulate a really nice gift to give my father. Now, I'm not thinking in terms of absolving the debt with it. That would be ludicrous. Just a nice gift, an accumulation of those coins and bills and everything. And to my amazement, when I started doing that, it seemed like some kind of floodgate opened up, and this stuff started pouring through here. And I remember these $100 gold certificates would come through. I'd have to ask my boss to hold them. Can you hold this for me? He'd hold it, and I'd get enough money and buy it. One time, there was a woman in AA who worked at the cage at the Horseshoe, and she knew I was doing this. And she called me up, and she said, you're not going to believe what we got here. We have a $500 gold certificate bill. And I said, oh man, are you kidding me? And I knew my dad would love that. And I said, would you hold that? And she said, I can't hold it very long. And I went and borrowed the money from someone to go down there and buy that out of the cage for $500 to put it in the collection. And in a little over 4 years, I had accumulated at face value the total amount of the debt. I mean, I had bags. I had a bag of wheat pennies that I could barely lift. I had a big bag of silver quarters that were just, I don't know how much, it was huge. A big bag of dimes. And I was estimating all the amount. And this was actually more than the debt. I had a shoebox full of gold and silver certificates. Face value, I had a lot of them. Quarters, nickels. I wore nickels, the ones that had the silver, and I had a ton of those. And I had all this stuff. And I went with Karen, who was the woman who was to be the mother of my daughter, and we drove back to Pennsylvania, and I gave all that stuff to my dad. And it blew his mind. He never expected it. He never expected it. And it created a big shift in my life and in my perception and in my relationship with my dad. Now, I have four years of making amends and being nice to him and things, and we were pretty good. But there was still something. There was still something that wasn't quite right with me and my father. Now, what I'm about to tell you, I don't know, truthfully, if this is my perception or if part of this is actual reality on his end. But it seemed to me that he loved me and he'd forgiven me, but he didn't respect me. It wasn't that he didn't love me. This is Rob. He's in a 12-step program. I was like special bus Bob, you know? It's like you got to make allowances for Bob. He's an alcoholic, you know, that kind of thing. Now, this could be imagined on my part. But when I gave him that money, it was like all of a sudden I felt like maybe I became a man in my dad's eyes. And our relationship shifted. It changed. It became very sweet. We started to be able to talk easily. And the awkwardness was starting to fade away. And I had him for about another year. And he died. And it was a sad thing. And I went back to Pennsylvania when he died to be supportive of my mother and sister. And I'll never forget this. I was sitting in my mother's kitchen. My sister's there. My mother's there. And they're talking to me and asking me questions and all kinds of things. And I had this moment that was just electric, where I realized that somehow the black sheep of the family has become the patriarch. And right after that, my mother sold her house and moved to Las Vegas to be around me. And not too long after that, my sister went through her first divorce and she moved to Las Vegas to be around her big brother. And I'll tell you, you can run away from home, they find you. And I was able to take care of my mom until she died. And more peeling the layers of the onion away of the amends that you don't even know you need until you take the actions and you realize they had more unfinished business, you know. And what a beautiful thing. See, if I would have believed what I believed, I'd have never done any of that because I didn't believe it was possible to change any of that. And if you're new, I hope you have a sponsor that believes and respects the principles outlined in this book and the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous to the point where they're willing to ignore you and push you gently into taking these actions, because these actions will change your life. Sheldon.
Hi, everybody. Sheldon Freddy, alcoholic. So I told you about the way that I went through my resentment list with my mom and my dad. And coming out of that fourth step with my folks, some healing had started to take place. I had started to see what it may have been like to have been them. I had started to imagine what it would have been like to be in their shoes. I'd started to get a glimpse, perhaps, of the things they'd gone through. And I started to want to have a relationship with them again. And my sponsor told me I had to make amends to my folks. So I went to my mom. My mom was living in Chicago at the time. I was living in Las Vegas. Similar kind of experience. My mom and my stepdad flew out to Vegas to check up on me. And while they were here, I was going to make amends to them. And I sat with my mom and my stepdad, and I told him how sorry I was for all the hurt I'd caused. I'd not only caused hurt to my mom and to him directly, but I put a lot of strain on their marriage when you have step-parents involved. The mom wants to help, and the stepdad doesn't want to help, and they're fighting and causing all kinds of problems between them. And I explained to them how sorry I was for all the stress I'd put on them, and then we came to the money, and they said, you know, guys, just like Bob and probably just like some of you, when I can't pay the rent, I call my mom or I call my dad. When I've got a fine that has to be paid, I call my mom or my dad. When I'm in trouble, I reach out to my parents for money. And I had a similar situation with a lot of dough that was owed over the years to my mom and my stepdad. And much like Bob, my mom says to me, "Don't worry about that. You don't owe us the money." Well, I've heard the war nickel silver certificate story at this point 100 times. I mean, I don't even know if it's true, but I'm not going to my sponsor saying, "Mommy said I didn't owe the money." I know that's not going to fly. So I said, well, Mom, that's really kind of you, but, you know, I'm in this 12-step program, and part of what I have to do if I expect to live long and happily in this world is I've got to make this debt right, and you've got to, please, I know you're trying to make a kind gesture, but it's not a gesture that I could live with, and I need you to accept this money. She said, no, 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 you don't understand. You don't owe the money. What do you mean? So, well, your aunt died, and she left you and your brother and your stepbrother a chunk of money. And I kept yours because you owed it to me. I was delighted. I'm like, this is good. This is going to fly. You know, in hindsight, looking back on this, I don't think I probably told Bob that part of the story because I stood at the time, I believed I told him and he said that was okay, but stood here today knowing what I know about Bob, he still wouldn't have allowed that to fly and I'd have still had to make the amends. But I just figured, well, you know, money that was my money, it was really my money, the money was paid, Mom and I are even. And I was delighted. A couple years later, maybe 4 or 5 years later, my mom decided she was going to move to Las Vegas. Now, she didn't move to Las Vegas to be near me. She moved to Las Vegas because I had her only grandchild. And thankfully, our relationship was repaired at that point to where I wasn't going to get in the way of her moving here. A few years earlier, she wouldn't have moved to Vegas even to be with that grandchild. But at least our relationship was repaired enough to where she would make the trip and move to Las Vegas. But it wasn't really properly repaired. Here's what it was like. I wanted to be a good AA member, so I would call my mom once a week. Once a week, you got to call your mom. That's what you do when you're in AA. You call your mom. So I would call my mom. Hi, Mom. How are you? It's Sheldon. Oh, hi, Sheldon. How are you? Good. I'm fine. How are you? Fine. Good. I'm fine. You're fine. I'm fine. Good. We're fine. 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 Right. I mean, that was the conversation every week. Fine. Fine. You're fine. I'm fine. I'm fine. You're fine. Fine. We're fine. Fine. Good. Fine. Click. Because I just want to be a good AA member, and I just want to make the phone call to tell my mom that everything's fine. But it's not fine because, you know, I have acquired a better attitude towards my mom. That much is true. But I'm still a little pissed off, right? I mean, I still lived in that house. She still screamed and yelled the way she screamed and yelled. I still lived the way that I lived. I still didn't really trust her. My wife, who's more of a family person than I am, who talks to her mom every day, would call my mom and talk to my mom. I didn't know she was calling my mom and talking to my mom. So I call my mom once a week. Hi, Mom. How are you? I'm fine. Fine. You're fine. Fine. How about that thing at work? What thing at work? How do you know about that thing at work? Well, I talked to Jackie. Jackie told me you had a thing at work. She did she? Well, that thing at work is fine. Honey? Are you calling my mom? Well, yeah, she's my mother-in-law. I want to have a relationship. Don't talk to her. I'm telling you, you can't trust her. Don't talk to her. You leave. Stay out of that. Well, now I got my grandson. I got her grandson. My son's born, and now she moves out to Las Vegas, and now she's coming to the house. And it's just, my behavior in front of her is cordial, and I behave myself because she's my mom, and I want to be a good AA member. But I tell you, when I know she's coming, I get a knot in my stomach. When I know she's coming, I just get up to, when the doorbell rings, I just, God, I wish I don't want it to be like this. I can't tell anybody. You can't talk about this in AA, because what I'm really saying is I'm not sure if I love my mommy. And I'm like 5, 6, 7, 8 years sober in AA, and it's bad if you don't love your mommy and you're in AA, right? I mean, that's not the kind of crap that you talk about. I mean, you can't look good in a meeting and be the guy that doesn't love his mommy, so everything's fine, right? I mean, we're just fine. Well, she's coming over to the house, and this is going on for a little bit, and Well, one day she's sitting at the house, and she tells me that she's having trouble with her car. Now, I'm in the car business. Cars are easy for me. I can get a car. Cars are easy. So I say to her, I say, you know, Mom, why don't we trade your car in? It's got some value. I'll get you another car. It'll be a couple $100 a month. I mean, at the time, I was doing pretty well financially. I couldn't even notice the $200 a month if I'd have tried to. Let me get your car. You know what she says to me? I don't want your charity. Imagine a mom saying to her son, imagine the angst that she must have still had in the relationship if she would consider her son, who's financially quite well healed, charity for him to get her a cheap car. It hurt me. I said, well, Mom, you know, and I just started talking bullshit because I'm a bullshitter. So I just said, Mom, I said, you know, I never really did make amends to you that day. That was Aunt's money. That wasn't my money. And I still kind of owe you. So why don't you let me make amends to you? I'm in the car. This will be easy for me. Let me get your car. Now, my stepdad is Scottish. I know you guys think that we Jews are cheap, but the Scots are unbelievable. I said, oh, let him get her a car, for God's sakes. It'll be free, you know. He was all excited about the prospect of a cool car, right? And so, oh, for clean out there, let him do it. Right? I mean, it was, we were in. He was like talking her into it. I didn't know how true what I was saying to her was. Because I wasn't saying it to her because I meant it. I was saying it to her because my ego needed to buy my mom a car and was wounded by the charity comment. I want you to know that I didn't realize that the amends still needed to be made. But I had never made the amends. I'm really grateful that I was sober a number of years at this time, because had this happened earlier in sobriety, I may not have had the view of what happened to be able to see what happened the way that I did, because it happened later in sobriety. But I got her a car. And it was a cheap car. And it was a couple of $100 a month, and it didn't mean anything to us. But we got her a car. She loved the car. And I started to make the payments on the car. When it says in the 9-step promises, you'll be amazed before you're halfway through, I think that is at the latest halfway through. I mean, it happened very quickly. I started to make a few payments on this car. And my mom, who had been this ogre, this mean-spirited ogre, transformed in front of my eyes. This woman who used to be judgmental and be full of opinions and be just mean-spirited, changed in front of my eyes. She was none of those things. My mom's 5'1". She's a little person, right? She loves her grandson. And she's not really good with kids. She wasn't good with us. She's not great with him. She struggles with the relationship with him. But her eyes beam when she looks at him. She loves him. She respects and loves her son. She loves our family. She just wants to be part of the deal. I couldn't see that. And the reason I couldn't see that was something that I would never have believed if you told me, but it was true. See, I owed. And if I'm going to owe, my ego has to write a story about you, making you the kind of person it would be okay for me to owe. I can't owe a kind little old lady who's just trying to get along and be friends with her grandson. I can't owe an ogre. I can't owe a woman that's judgmental and mean and you don't understand. I had to create a story about my mom that was the kind of person that if I told you about my mom, you'd go, well, I probably wouldn't pay her either. I had to write a story. But as I made amends, as I cleaned my side of the street, it wasn't her side of the street for me to be concerned with. I had to put out of my mind the wrongs others had done. But as I cleaned my side of the street, I no longer needed the story about how evil she was to justify to my ego the fact that I'd never made the amends. And so the story disappeared, and she turned into what she really is, which is an old lady. She's not old. She's 70-something. She's had a tough life. She's in a marriage to a guy she's been with for 30 years. When they got married, he was a bad drunk. He's now in AA. She's been in Al-Anon for a long time. They're doing as well as they possibly could. She loves her grandson. She loves her grandson. She loves me. And it's not perfect. It's not this storybook relationship. But it's the best relationship I have ever had with my mom. and I wouldn't have had it. See, when I make the amends to people, I'm not just making the amends to people for Bob, the way Bob's story, and that is a beautiful story. And it talks about how Bob made the amends to his dad so his dad could see Bob the way Bob, in the light that Bob wanted his dad to see him. And that is 50% of why we make the amends. But I made the amends to my mom and I got a different thing. It allowed me to see my mom how my mom really is because I didn't have an agenda anymore. And both things happen. I'm sure that unbeknownst to Bob, or maybe Bob's aware of it, but his dad probably changed in his eyes when he became even. Not from a scary, evil dad, but from someone that he was, could look in the eye himself. You know, the reason that I walk around looking at the floor or looking over your shoulder, or feeling ashamed or feeling guilty is because I am. Right? The reason I have to defend myself from you is because you have bullets in the gun that I gave you. And by clearing that stuff up, I got to see my mom for what she really is. And she got to see me for what she really is. It's a funny story. You know, Bob and I's story are very similar here. My mom moved to Vegas after I got involved and active in Alcoholics Anonymous. My dad, I'm going to talk about my dad, he ended up living in Las Vegas. He moved to live near me. When my family has problems, it's my kitchen table that the family comes to. I become that guy. It's insane. It's ridiculous that I'd be the guy they came to based on my track record 18 years ago. But you know, for the last 18 years, it's not so crazy. For the last 18 years, it kind of makes sense that I'd be the guy that they would come to because of the direction that you have given me, because of the way of living that you have provided for me. My dad, I made amends to my dad, and I love my dad. I mean, I love my dad. My dad, the real story, I told him what I thought the possibility was of why he left. And what he said was, it's a nice story. It's not true. It's a nice story. He said the reason that I left was because there was a younger, prettier girl, and I just wanted to go be with the younger, prettier girl. And, you know, for a minute I was a little angry, and then I thought to myself, you know what? I have been betting my life for years on a story of this evil guy that left, and it served me horribly. But the one thing that I learned in my fourth step was that it was possible that I was wrong. It's something I'd never considered. I don't know if you're like me, but I'm not good at considering that I'm possibly wrong. I get, right? I get 15 or 20% of the information. I make up the rest of the story, and the story is true. And it was a beautiful lesson that I learned that I could possibly be wrong in that moment in my fourth and fifth step with my sponsor. But my dad is my dad. And we formed a relationship again, and we talked about amends, and he kind of laughed, and he said, you know, Sheldon, you're doing pretty well financially, and I don't got no money. And I'm not going to be able to take care of myself when I'm old. So don't worry, kid. You hold that money in a bank account. I'm coming for it. I'm coming for it. You'll pay me back. Oh, okay, Dad. And I did. He moved to Las Vegas, and I helped him with a condo. And he moved near us, and we started to form a relationship again. My dad's a gambler, and I remember calling my sponsor when my dad got arrested for stealing from Target. He was working there, and he was taking $20 a day out of the cash register to feed the slot machines. And I called him, and I said, Bob, I said, you won't believe where I am. He said, where are you? I said, I'm in a bail bondsman's office, bailing my dad out of Clark County Detention Center because for his gambling habit, he's been stealing. And my sponsor laughed his ass off. He said, well, you're getting close to even. Not quite what I had in mind. But we have, me and my dad have this good relationship, and he's living in Vegas. My dad's a fun guy. My dad had a great relationship with my son, and my son loves him, and my wife loves him. He's at my house every single day. Now, I thought that was because they loved the family. It turned out because he had no food in the house. He'd show up at dinner time. Just wanted to see what you guys were doing. Oh, Dad, I'm glad you're here. Let's have dinner. Oh, thank God, right? But that was just part of who my dad was. And my dad just, he's just a lovable rascal. My dad. I fall back in love with my dad. My dad goes back to England, where we're from, for a family reunion, and he meets a woman. And it's a woman that he knew briefly when he was in high school, but they knew all the same people, and it was his hometown. And he fell in love with her, and he decided he wanted to go back and live in England again. And I lost it. I lost it because, you know, finally, I guess finally I've got my dad back in my life. Finally, I'm having a relationship with my dad that I never, ever had. And it broke my heart he was leaving again. And my son, who is in love with my father, my son... I calls him Grandpapa, and just loves the guy, and just was crazy about him, and now he's going to break my son's heart, and he's going to go back to England. Now, he already did this once to me, you understand, and I'm starting to get over them. I'm starting to forgive the son of a bitch for leaving me when I was two. Right? But now he's going to leave my son. Now he's going to do to my son exactly what he did to me. I let him back in my life, and he's doing it again. He's doing it twice, and I tell you, I'm pissed. I mean, my son, the truth is that he don't really care. I mean, he's going to miss his grandpa, but he's got two parents that love and adore him, and he's going to be fine. But inside me, I think I've got some weird childhood issues that are coming up again, and I hate him. I mean, I'm pissed. And he moves back to England, and I'm at my sponsor's house, and I'm losing my mind, that son of a bitch. And I'm, like, mad at my sponsor, because you know why? Because he made me let him back in my life. He made me do it. He made me make those goddamn amends. He made me let him back in the house. He made me make those phone calls. If he hadn't made me make those goddamn phone calls, I'd have never let him back in my life, and we'd be fine, thank you very much. But that son of a bitch... I wish I was 3 years sober when all this was going on. Yeah. This would be a lot better story. But I think I was 16. I was 15 or 16. Well, you know, some of you guys know Bob, some of you don't. He's not a sponsor that yells at his sponsors. He just isn't. He's a very kind guy. But he yelled at me. And he told me to stop it. And I tell you, what he said to me was bizarre. Because this is what he said. He said, knock it off and listen. He said, you got some choices you got to make, and you're going to make them right now. And whatever choices you make, I will support you in. I will stand next to you, and we will figure out how to execute your choices, but you need to know what your choices are, because you're going to make them now. Your dad is 70-some years old, and he's not a well man, and he's going to die. And you might have 5 years, or you might have 10 years. Let's say you've got 10 years. If you want to punish him for 10 years and make the last 10 years of your father's life miserable, good for you. But if you'd like to, instead, you can try and have a relationship with him that has forgiveness and understanding and love for the last 10 years of his life. And you can choose how you want to treat your dad for the next 10 years. But in 10 years, he'll die. And then you'll live for another, hopefully, 30 years after that. And for 30 years after your dad's gone, you're going to get to choose what memories you're going to have of your dad. But you have to choose now. You're going to choose to either have memories of hate and anger and disappointment, or you're going to choose to have memories that involve compassion and love and kindness. And 30 years later, you're going to die. And then your son will live another 30 years. And for 30 years from then, or 70 years from now, you're going to get to choose what kind of memories your son has as his grandfather. Pick wisely. He's either going to have an angry, worthless, no good son of a bitch of a grandfather, or he's going to have a grandfather that did the best he could, made some mistakes, but was a kind old man. Pick it. What do you want to do? One more thing. Do you think you'll ever let your son down? Well, of course I'm going to let my son down. I'm not perfect. Well, when you do, what do you want to teach your son that the Fedi men do when their father lets them down? Do you want to teach your son that when his father screws up, that you nail him up on a cross? Or do you want to teach him love and kindness? Well, thanks for the choice, Bob. Oh, is there a door number 3? So of course I want to find a way to let my dad off the hook. Of course I want to find a way to forgive my dad. Of course I want to find a way to do that. The book says that when we approach the man that we still hated, which implies that we make amends to people we still hate. This crazy notion that crept into Alcoholics Anonymous somewhere, that we forgive someone before we make the amends, I don't know where it came from. The book says we put the bit in our teeth. That doesn't mean bite a bullet bit. It means a directional bit, like a horse might have in its mouth, where you do the goddamn work anyway, whether you feel it or not. Somewhere in a treatment center, somebody said to somebody once, well, I know I need to make the amends here, but I just don't feel it here yet. And when I forgive them and feel it, then I'll make the amends. And of course we liked that, right? It's not in the book. Right, but we dug the idea, so we grabbed a hold of it and ran with it. But it's not what I was taught. What do we do with the man we still hated? We still make amends. So I got to find a way to make amends to my dad, whether I'm angry with him or not. I got to find a way to make amends to my dad, whether I feel it in my heart or not. Because like I say to the guys that I sponsor from time to time, they'll call me and they'll be telling me about some thing that's happened in their life that's crazy. They'll be telling me what they did and about them and all about them. And I'll say to them, depending on how much time I have, if I'm real busy, I'll stop them right away. But if I've got time in the day, I'll go, you know, geez, we can do this for about another 15 minutes. But at some point we have to do AA. Which means we have to put out of our minds the wrongs others have done. At some point we got to do AA. Don't have to do it yet. Can do it later if you like, right? But at some point we got to do AA. Talking about them ain't doing AA. Right? We got put out of our minds wrong. So I want to make amends to my dad. I start praying and thinking about it. How am I going to make amends to my dad? And then I get the phone call. My dad's sick. He's going to have a surgery that he might not live through. 50-50. If he lives through the surgery, it might buy him a year. But it's 50-50 that he's going to live. So I book a plane ticket, and I go get on the plane, and I talk to my sponsor, and I see something for the first time in my life that I couldn't see. When we talked about the resentment part of the imagery, I told you that my sponsor tried to say to me something that I goofed on. He tried to say to me that my dad probably did the best for me that he could with the tools he was provided. And I goofed on him. Want to know what I figured out? My dad did the best for me that he could with the tools that were provided. He did the best he could. My dad wasn't kidding. I created a picture of what I thought a father should be. Then it changed to a divorced father. I created a picture of what I thought a single father should be. And then I got mad at my dad because he couldn't live up to the picture that I created. It wasn't even him. I didn't even create a picture of him. I created a picture of somebody else. It's not his fault he couldn't live up to what I expected him to be. I knew he loved me. He would cry when he dropped me off at my mom's. He wasn't going to see me for 6 months or a year because he lived in another country. Broke his heart. He would send me letters. He would make me phone calls. He did the best he could. But I couldn't say that to him because I couldn't find a way. And I'm glad this wasn't early sobriety, because in early sobriety, I might have found a way to say this. But at 16 years of sobriety, 17 years of sobriety, 16 years, I couldn't bring myself to say to him, Dad, I know you love me and I know you did the best you could with the tools that you were provided with. Because to me, what it sounded like was, Dad, it's not your fault. You just weren't man enough to be my father. Dad, it's not your fault. I know you wish you were a better person than you were. But because I'm in AA, I forgive you for being a failure and a failure. And I'm sure you're glad to hear that. I had to find a way to let my dad off the hook, and I couldn't find a way to let him off the hook, and I got on the plane, and I'm flying over to England, and I'm praying, and it came to me. It just came to me. We're sitting in the hospital room before he goes into the surgery. When he comes out of the surgery, he's going to be in intensive care, and I'm not going to be able to talk to him. And I sit down at a table, and I sit down, I'll talk to you. He said, "What's up, son?" I said, "I want you to know, I'm really grateful that you are my father." And he said, "What are you talking about?" Now, my dad's a smart guy. There's no way that a guy as intelligent as my dad could have been my father and thought he did a good job, right? I mean, he was a lousy pie. He did the best he could, but the best he could wasn't very good. And he knew that. But if he didn't know that, if he'd have been asleep and blind and stupid, trust me, I had told him several times that he was a lousy father. I made absolutely goddamn clear, nose to nose, spitting at each other in arguments, time after time, that I thought he was a son of a bitch and a no good bum and he should never have left. So even if he was asleep to it, he knew that I thought he was no good. He said, "What are you talking about? I was a lousy father." I said, "That's not what I mean. I got a good life, Pops. I got a good life. I see, you know, I'm a salesman. And it affords my family a very good living. And my mom's not a salesman. You're a salesman, Dad. You, from your DNA, and then from the lessons you taught me that short time I lived here in California, you gave me the gift that I have as my sales ability that allows me to take care of my family. If it wasn't you being my father, I may not have that ability. Pop, some people tell me I got a good sense of humor. Some people tell me I'm funny. You're funny, Dad. Mom, not so funny." That is a gift that comes from you being my dad. I'm just like you, Pops, in a lot of ways. We have a similar personality in a lot of ways. When we're together, we're like two peas in a pod. I like who I am. I like what my life has become. And my life has become what it's become because you're my dad. If you were not my father, I would be a different man. And I like the man I am today. And I am grateful that you are my father. And I want to thank you for being my father. And he started to cry. Of course. And I thought, that's why I came to England. I did it. This should be in the grapevine. And then my dad looks up. And he says, "You know, I'm dying." I said, "I know. I might not make it through the surgery, and if I do, I got about a year or so left. So I know that." He said, "I don't have much of a spiritual idea. I don't know much about God." He said, "I don't know if when I die, I'm dead, the lights go out, and the game's over. I don't know. I don't know if I go and face a judgment day. I don't know. If I do, I don't know how well I'll fare. I don't know. But if what happens is I get to come back around and go through this world again, I hope I can come back as the kind of man I've watched you to grow into in Alcoholics Anonymous." And that's why I went to England. Because the gift that I was given from my father that day was that somewhere inside of me there was a broken piece of me that broke back in 1971 when my dad left him. There was something inside of me that was damaged and it got healed. And it got healed. I came home and about a year later, actually December of 2013, my wife and my son went back to England to spend a vacation with him because he was very, very ill. And my wife had had a horrible argument with him because of some of the stuff that had happened between me and him. And they were once close. And my dad and I had made amends, but she hadn't seen him yet. And so she got to come and spend a week with my father, and they got to be okay. And my son's last memory of my father in my house was of my wife throwing him out. And he got to spend a vacation and spend time with me and my father and him and his father and his grandfather and my wife. And the four of us got to have an amazing trip together. And when we left, they knew they were saying goodbye to him and they wouldn't see him again. And then in February, I got to go back to England and sit by his bed. And he was getting sicker and sicker. I was blessed enough to be able to make the trip to Britain three or four times in that six-month period. And on February the 26th of last year, my father passed away. And I was with him in the room. My brother and I were both there. My brother said he had to go to do some errands. And he asked me to go with him, and I started to leave the hospital. I was in the hospital parking lot. And I said to my brother, I said, you know, I don't know where I'm going. I got nowhere to be but my dad's side. Dad was not conscious. Dad was not conscious, but I just wanted to be by his side. My brother drove away, and 10 minutes later, my dad took his last breath. And I got to hold his hand as he left this planet. The next day, I got to give a eulogy at his funeral. In the Jewish faith, we bury very quickly. And he died at 2 o'clock one afternoon and was buried at noon the next day. And I got to give the eulogy. I'm not haunted by my father. I miss my dad. I really do. He's a guy that, he was funny, and you could call him and talk to him about anything. Things happen in my life that are exciting. It would be nice to be able to share it with him. But I'm not haunted by him. And here's why that's amazing. Because before he died, 5 years ago, 3 years ago, 10 years ago, I was haunted by him while he was still here. Things would happen that would remind me of my childhood, and I'd think that rotten son of a bitch. A TV show that he'd liked would come on, or a movie he'd liked would come on, and I'd get twisted in my stomach, and I'd be angry at my dad. I only was able to give my dad about a year of good memories with his wife and his son, with my wife and my son and his son. I wasn't able to give him 5 or 10 years like Bob had hoped. It was only 1 year. But I got to give him that year. I'm hoping that I get to live for 30 or 40 years. But I know that for every one of those years, I won't be haunted or tormented or tortured by memories of my dad. I'm sad when I think about him now, and hopefully the sadness may fade a little. But I'm filled with joy when I think of his sense of humor and the way that he was and some of the things that he did, and I'm sure over time that'll grow. My wife has fond memories of her father-in-law. My son, all he knows is that he loved his grandpapa, and his grandpapa was funny. And that's what he's going to remember for the next 30 or 40 years, 50 years, 60 years. And when I screw up, as I will, I hope I have taught my son the lesson of love and forgiveness and tolerance, because I know I'm going to let him down. And when I do, if he's as much of a knucklehead as I am, I hope he's got someone as loud as Bob to set him on the right track. And I'm forever grateful for that. I'm forever grateful for that. Making amends is about fixing relationships. It's about putting the ghost to bed. It's about clearing away the wreckage of the past so we can have a good and wonderful future. Hopefully, I have learned enough to allow the past to be put to rest by the actions that I have to do to mend the damage that I did to allow myself a wonderful future. We have a 15-minute break, and then we're going to come back and do step 10.